Okay, we're up to part 4, chapter 2.
Because the largest number of recorders.
Part 4, chapter 2. This is the study of the Torah. Now, he says that the study of the Torah is very necessary, because without it, you can't get to doing. You don't know what to do, so you're not able to do it. But in addition to this, in study, there's a great purpose for the perfection of the human being. And we're going to discuss it in great detail. I cannot resist telling you one thing about this subject. Anybody here understand any Hebrew grammar? Study the Hebrew grammar? Okay, let's do a job on Talmud. Talmud. The root is Lamad. Lamad usually means to learn. Now, what kind of word is Talmud? What binyan does it come from? Well, how did they make it?
Talmud is a student, right?
Say again? Talmud is a student. Talmud is a study. That's the way it's usually understood. But I want the grammatical analysis. Where does it come from?
Yeah.
I want grammar. I want Hebrew grammar. You're telling me English. What?
Future.
It's from Hitler.
Sorry?
Hitler.
I can't hear you.
Like from Hitler head.
Well, that would be... Where's the hits? What happened to the hits? They disappeared? Talmud. Can you think of parallels from another verb that you could get something out of? How about Tanchum Avelin, comforting the mourners? What's the verb from which Tanchum comes? Lenachem. Tashlum Schar, paying somebody his wages. Tashlum comes from Leshalem. So Talmud would come from Lelamed. Lelamed. Now what does Lelamed mean?
To teach.
So I think Talmud means teaching, not learning. This would mean that 99.9% of all the translations in English are wrong. Talmud, I believe, means teaching Torah, not learning Torah. And if you will open up the Rambam, in Hilchos Talmud Torah, this is what you will read. Every person has to teach his child Torah. And not only his child, but he has to teach his grandchildren Torah. And every wise person, scholarly person that will teach all of the possible students Torah. Students are called children. And then it says a person who can't teach his child personally should hire a teacher for his child. And then it says, now listen carefully, it says, if a person wasn't taught by his father, then chayev lelamed es atzmo. He's obligated to teach himself. Lelamed es atzmo. It's as if the Rambam is allergic to the verb to learn. He doesn't want to say learn. Teach a child, teach a grandchild, teach all the students who could possibly be. Hire a teacher for your child. And then when it comes to yourself, teach yourself. Doesn't say to learn. And it's even more striking because the verse that he quotes, when he says you have to teach yourself, is the verse that says, Ulamatatem osam lasoso, which is the verb in the Hebrew, in the Torah, in the kal, meaning to learn, and the Rambam won't use it. He won't use to learn. No, he says to teach yourself. See, he holds that learning is just what we would call the asymptotic case, the most extreme case of teaching, where you are both the teacher and the student. You're teaching yourself. But the verb to learn he doesn't want to use. It's amazing. I think I see in the Rambam here confirmation of the idea that Talmud Torah is essentially teaching Torah. That's the correct translation. Another little piece of evidence for it. In the Shulchan Aruch, it says that everyone is obligated to study through Talmud Torah. Okay? But there he's talking about studying. Old and young, rich and poor, healthy and ill, everybody has to study Torah. What will happen if a person is in circumstances where it's impossible or extremely difficult, he's ill or he has other people that depend upon him, or it's wartime or whatever it is? So if he can't do it himself, he should at least support other people who are learning Torah. That's what Yosef Karo said in Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah, Rosh Isserles, adds the following comment, that if he supports other people learning Torah, it is counted to him as if he learned the Torah. And I think the critic will say, Ma pito? What's one thing got to do with the other? There's a mitzvah of learning Torah, and then there's another responsibility that every Jew has to help other Jews do mitzvahs, to help them in any way you can. If this guy's learning and that guy's helping, helping is helping and learning is learning. Why would the Ramah add this qualification? And by the way, he wants you to know that if A helps B in learning Torah, so it's counted to A as if he's learning Torah. Why should that be? But according to what I'm telling you, it's very good, because teaching Torah means causing greater knowledge and understanding of Torah in the world. That's what teaching means. So if I teach somebody else, I'm causing greater understanding. If I open the book and read myself, I'm causing greater understanding in my head. It's also causing greater understanding. And if I support somebody else to learn, I'm causing greater understanding. So the essential impact is there, even when you're paying money to support somebody else. So I think Talmud Torah means teaching Torah, and you can quote me on it. Won't get you into trouble, get me into trouble. People don't believe it, and if they don't believe it, you can refer them to me. I'd love to hear their objections. I think that's what it means. At any rate, I'm just mentioning it to you as an idea. I don't think that he says anything here that counts one way or the other. Okay, so one thing in the study of Torah is knowing what to do. Another is a great contribution to man's perfection. And that's what he wants to explain. Now paragraph 2. Among the many, I've called them energies, influences, that God put into the world for the sake of his creatures, there's one, highest of all. Its essence is greater in glory and elevation, greater than anything else that there is in the creation. Mm-hmm. Look at these words, man. Look at these words. Behind them, and that is to say that it is the purpose. Tachlis, no. Purpose is extent. The purpose is limited. It's the limit of what can be found in the created world among the creations, which is of the same category as God's own existence and glory and elevation, which is similar to his very existence. Something which God shares of his kavod. We spoke about kavod. We spoke about prophecy, right? He said the object of prophecy was God's glory. This is the sharing of his glory and his honor, greatness to his creatures. In other words, through the study of Torah, the creature takes on for himself a mode of being as similar to God's mode of being as you can have in this world, as a creature can have in this world. It's an enormous statement. We'll have to try to understand what that means. I mean, you're sitting and reading a book. So what? You're absorbing ideas. So what? Why would sitting and absorbing ideas make you as similar to God as God's being as any creature could be in this world? Well, why would that be the connection? Why not doing charity? Why not prayer? Why not, I don't know, celebrating the holidays or something else, bringing sacrifices? Why would the study of Torah have that specific, unique?
Because it embraces a lot of things. If you study Torah, you will get to pray, you will get to do charity, you will get to revere prayer.
No, but see, that's not correct. He starts off in the first paragraph by saying that the study of Torah has two aspects. One is that it will bring you to action, and there's the second one. We're talking about the second one now. Bringing to action is a different one. So he took care of the first paragraph. He's not talking about that. Mm-hmm. He's talking about the study itself. Now, before we get to that, which is a deep, deep matter, let's just read some of the details, some of the conditions. However, he says, so first of all, he says he put that influence in the world. We haven't said anything where it is yet or how he gets to it. It's there. Now, he tied, the Creator tied that influence to an item, a thing, which was created for this purpose. In other words, first he put that influence in the world somehow. That's itself, for people in metaphysics, is interesting. Put it in without any vehicle. Just put it there. Then he created something whose function will be to carry that influence. And that's the Torah. So in that respect, the Torah doesn't come first. The Torah comes second. First there's that influence, and then the Torah is created to be the item to which the influence will be tied. Now, and then of course he has to tie it. Now, why would that be? Why would he create the influence, then create the Torah as the item to carry it, and then tie them together? That's three stages. Why not just create the Torah with that influence as part of it? The reason is, as he's going to say in a couple of pages, that interacting with the Torah is no guarantee that you will have access to this influence. It's not guaranteed. Because it's not internal to the Torah, it's external. It's a separate creation. And it's tied. But it's tied with conditions. Certain conditions have to be fulfilled so that when you interact with the Torah, you get access to that influence. If it were internal, if it were essential, then it would be more or less automatic. More or less automatic unless you actively blocked it out. But no, it's not internal, it's not essential, it's external. It's only tied externally, which means that there are conditions for your interacting with that influence, and he will specify what those conditions are. Now, he says, this purpose, this idea, will be completed in two respects, or two aspects of interacting with the Torah. And here he says something which is really also, I would say, shocking. Does he translate it this way? Yeah, he says it right. Through recitation and comprehension. Reciting the Torah and understanding. Now here he means the written Torah. And the written Torah for him means the whole Tanakh, the whole of the Bible. And he's telling you that reciting the words without any comprehension at all still does give you some access to this highest influence. Then there's comprehension. And the more comprehension you have, the greater connection you have. The greater connection, the greater interaction, the more it does for you. But reciting the words, that means pronouncing the syllables without any comprehension at all, still has some of this effect. Now, my guess is, to most people that sounds very peculiar. Just saying the sounds? Just saying the sounds? How could that possibly be? And I believe that if that's the way you feel, and it was definitely the way I felt when I first said it, that's because at base, all of us are partly Greek. We're all partly Greek. We all have a prejudice in favor of the mind, the intellect, brains, smarts. And if you cut out the smarts, how significant can it be? How important can it be? How meaningful can it be? But the Jewish point of view is not like that. Yes, brains are important, but the basis of the thing is not brains. The basis of the thing is that there's a Creator who's infinitely beyond all of our brains. And He created an influence, and He created a vehicle, a tool, with which people can access that influence, and He made it possible to access it under the conditions that He determined. And since God, the Creator, is not just super Aristotle, or super Socrates, He doesn't have to follow those rules. We shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be surprised. Because there's no Jewish reason to be surprised. There's only a Greek reason to be surprised. We should meditate on the fact that we have Greek reflexes, you know, with Greek instincts. So that even reciting the words without comprehension, we're talking now about the Torah Shebe Ksav, the written Torah of the Bible, that has that effect. Though, the more understanding you have, the better it is. because roughly the more of you is involved. So the more of you is involved, the more, then of course the more contact you have, the more interaction you have. You with me so far?
Yeah. If you only knew the second step of the comprehension, wouldn't you assume that you could draw a conclusion that if you didn't have any comprehension, you wouldn't get any shefa? That means even if you're just reciting it, you wouldn't get any shefa, and that's why we have that reaction for it.
Correct.
So it's not just a Greek idea. It's also sounds if you only knew the second part, a Jewish idea. That if the more you want,
yes, to no, but that's not the question. The question is: suppose I don't know anything. Suppose I say there is this influence, and the Torah is its vessel. By interacting with the Torah, you can have connection with the influence. Now, what kinds of interactions would you guess will have this effect? You're not told anything.
Okay.
I think everybody would say, well, of course, the more you understand it, the better off you are. Very few people would think that just reciting it without understanding it would have that effect. And when you hear it, you're a little surprised. You'd expect it all to be on the understanding side, because we have this intellectualistic prejudice. Okay, now, this is what we explained, he says over there in the first part, where he did it very much, very briefly, that the Creator authored the general words and sayings which comprise the five books of Moses, the Chumash, and after them and lower than them in status, the prophets and the writings, and he tied to them, meaning all of them, the Torah, the prophets and the writings, this highest influence, in such a way that when the words will be said, that influence will be drawn to the one who says them. On the condition that this speech will have the requirements that I will explain to you, shortly. And also, with understanding, that understanding that is included in those words, in true fashion, meaning not everybody's study is going to be equal. And if you have Ya'el Dayan, who will study the story of David and Jonathan and will tell you that it's a homosexual relationship, she's not getting it. Not only isn't she getting the pshat, isn't she getting what the words mean, but she's not getting any interaction with this highest influence. So also, this influence will be available to the ones who understand it. And he says there are many different levels in this influence, like in other influences. Whatever God puts into the world, there are many different levels. And it depends upon the particular speech and the particular understanding. Okay. Now, he says, it's obvious that the greater the understanding, the greater the interaction with that influence will be. Someone who understands just the meanings of the words will not be on the level of someone who understands the true intention, or the superficial intention, and the deeper the intention you understand, the greater it will be. But this was God's loving kindness, that in any level of understanding, and even just in speaking, there will be some interaction. Which I think is a kind of, you could think of it as a kind of democratic gesture. It's available to everybody. It's available to everybody who can read. And I think it was rare to find a time when Jews couldn't at least read the words. They knew the sounds of the letters and could sound out the words. And he says, in addition to the fact that there are different levels, depending upon how much you get, the reward that a person gets to study is dependent upon his effort. The more effort, the more reward. So it means that you're not limited. If you never get to the deeper levels, that doesn't mean you're limited in the effect that it can have on you in terms of your reward. It all depends upon the effort that you invest in. Now he says, this is something which is really practical. I don't know if it's practical for you right away, but it's practical as a kind of long-term goal. That a person has a responsibility to occupy himself with all sections of the Torah. Not all sections equally, and not to master all of them, that's impossible for almost anybody. But at least have some connection with each section. That means a person should think over his lifetime, I have to try to get to this and try to get to that. The Talmud, Yerushalmi, the Tanakh, eventually the Zohar. Something to invest some time at some point in life to touch some element. And the reason he says is this, that, as I'm sure you've heard many times, God created the Torah, then he looked into the Torah and created the world. The Torah is the blueprint of the creation. Which means that every part of the creation is linked to some part of the Torah. I'm not sure vice versa is correct. Many parts of the Torah that are linked to things beyond this world. But every part of the creation is linked to some part of Torah. And therefore, a person who wants to bring that influence into the world should try at least to invest in bringing that influence to all the different parts of creation.
So Torah acts as a medium.
Torah is, well, it is a medium. It is a medium. That's right. It is a medium, yeah. So if you want to serve God, to serve God in as complete a fashion as possible, as to try to occupy yourself with all the different parts of the Torah, each person according to his ability. And in that way, he will bring perfection to the creation as a whole. That's why it says in the Gemara, the person should divide his time. And if you look carefully, he says, the Gemara condition says, it covers all the different elements of the Torah, because he holds, and this is an interesting point of view, that there's the written Torah, which is the Tanakh, plus explanation. Everything else in the Torah is explanation of the written Torah. Now, of course, there are explanations on many levels, and some of you have heard me speak about the idea that, as he says in the Essay on Fundamentals, that what God wants to get from the Torah is his communication. And his communication is described by rules that he gave for decoding the text to get his communication from it. So I'm not limited to, nor necessarily even prefer, I give preference to, the simple meanings of the words. That's what he wants to communicate. But at any rate, it is the center, the text is the center, and everything revolves around it in one way or another. So you have the written and the accompanying explanatory material, let's put it that way. Which means everything else you learn is considered a deeper understanding of the written. And therefore, when he says that this influence is attached to the Torah, he means it's attached to the written Torah. And the oral comes in as deeper understanding of the written. And since it's deeper understanding of the written, you get more influence in interaction with that influence. That's the picture that he's giving us. Yeah.
I remember hearing that, it might not be true, that today we hold that studying Gemara can, or Talmud can be taken as the bulk of your time because it's said to cover Tanakh and everything.
Yeah, so this is in fact a statement by Rabbeinu Tam, and it's quoted in Tosis, when it's in the word, it says to divide your time into three, Tanakh, Mishnah, and Gemara. So Rabbeinu Tam said, when you study the Gemara, it's quoting verses all the time. When you study the Gemara, it's quoting Mishnayos from various places all the time. So if you spend the bulk of your time on Talmud, you are getting those three. I think there's no question that is true. However, Ramchal was famous for holding that without the study of Kabbalah, the person has missed out on an essential dimension. And to get this Kabbalah from the Talmud, you have to be a revolving genius. You know, there are a lot of hints. There are a lot of hints in the Talmud to the basic themes of the Kabbalah, but they're only hints. And I think I've mentioned maybe this was a long time ago. There was a controversy for a while, and then the academics have never recovered from it. They're still fighting the controversy. That what we call the Kabbalah was really made up by a fellow named Moshe de Leon the 14th century, when the Zohar was published. Now, there's a fellow at the university named Moshe Eidel, and he wrote a book called New Perspectives in Kabbalah. And he argued that this cannot be correct. And by the way, he's not Orthodox, so therefore everything he says is trustworthy and valid and balanced and scholarly and objective. If you're Orthodox, you think he's just an apologist, but he's not Orthodox, so that's okay. And he says that the idea that the whole of the Kabbalah, the whole system, the whole thought system was made up in the 14th century is absurd. And that Gershon Scholem, who was, in academic terms, the greatest scholar of the Kabbalah in the 20th century, and who held this, and that the earliest strength of it came from Neoplatonism, Gershon Scholem was ignorant of rabbinic texts and prejudiced against them. That's what he says. Moshe Eidel says, and he's a student of Scholem. And that if you look back into the Talmud and the Midrash, you can see many of the themes of the Kabbalah hinted at. So that the idea that we were influenced by, let's say, the Neoplatonists, the Talmud and the Midrash are before the Neoplatonists, certainly before our contact with the Neoplatonists. And one of the interesting proofs he brings is that the publication of the Zohar did not cause a great deal of controversy. There was some. There was some discussion whether Moshe de Leon made it up or whether he, you know, like he wrote it in Rabbi Shimon Echai's name, or Rabbi Abba's name, but it wasn't really a text that served up throughout the time. But the controversy over Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed was much worse. It was much worse. The Zohar was never burned anywhere. Whereas Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed was burned in Paris, burned publicly by the rabbinic authorities. Not by the church, but by the rabbinic authorities as a work of heresy. So Eidel says, it can't be that this was a brazen doctrine and made up and as a result of external influences. It would have caused a gigantic controversy and it wouldn't have died down as quickly as it died down. So there is definitely an element of the tradition that goes back at least to Rishon Bar Yochai, and we would say goes back much further. At any rate, says the Ramchal, without that, there's a dimension of understanding the Torah that's missing. He even says more than that, there's certain mitzvahs that you can only fulfill if you study the Kabbalah, and therefore it's a necessary dimension. And this you will not get from studying the Talmud, unless you have to say you're that kind of revolving genius. Okay, let's talk about the conditions, and then maybe I'll try to fill you in on the thing that I skipped over. How is this highest influence give you an existence similar to that of God himself? Okay, now he says there are two conditions for a person who's studying, speaking and or studying Torah to interact with that highest influence. One is that the study has to be accompanied with awe of God, and number two, it has to be accompanied with a reasonable level of mitzvah, doing right actions. Without awe, and without some level of keeping mitzvahs, obviously nobody's perfect at keeping mitzvahs. If it were a requirement of perfection, nobody would be able to get anything out of it. Without some awe, and without some level of keeping mitzvahs, the energy is not available. The person can study it up and down, and it will have no effect on anything. Not on him and not on the world. And this is how you can have professors of Talmud at universities who spend their whole lifetime studying Talmud. They're doing nothing. They're doing nothing for themselves. They're doing nothing for the world except misleading their students with their mistakes.
They have no benefit from reading it.
Nope. That's why I said these conditions are necessary for interacting with the vehicle to connect you with the influence that it's a vehicle for. Even reading will do nothing. Now,
but if they only read, they don't comprehend. But in case of professors, it is very different.
They think they comprehend. They read the words and they misunderstand the concepts and they
because they comprehend, they're taken away from that influence, right?
Again, you can read and comprehend everything if you don't have awe of God. And if you don't, so these professors typically don't have it.
So if you have somebody who doesn't have education, could just read.
That's right, he has it.
Yeah.
And the great professor who understands everything back and forth gets nothing out of it. Not for him and not for the world, because he doesn't fulfill his mitzvah. Because this is a spiritual performance. This is not an academic performance. That's the point here. It's a spiritual performance. And the person who can understand it academically and have no spirit in it whatsoever.
They don't perform to his abilities, basically.
What's that?
They don't perform to their abilities. Professors who comprehend but don't perform. They don't
perform mitzvot, and they don't have awe of God. They don't have awe of God. I mean, there are religious professors, of course, and they do qualify, but the rest of them certainly don't. So he says, this influence is only available for those who are related in the way to which God tied it to the Torah. And without doing it the way he set it up, it won't have any effect at all. And studying the Torah will be like studying chemistry. It'll have no more effect on these people than studying chemistry. Any kind of science or natural information. Not for the soul of the person doing this reading or studying, but for the world as a whole. And he said, this is a godly thing, and it's the highest of all the godly things that God put into the universe. So now, certainly a person should have awe, and he should tremble in being occupied with this item, because he's coming before his God, and he's using God's greatest light that he put into the world. Shouldn't he be embarrassed at his own smallness and his own insignificance and be struck, awestruck with God's greatness and be full of joy at the great benefit that God made available to him? But joy with trembling, Gilu Bar Odis, quoting the Pasuk. And therefore he shouldn't be Kalis Rosh, I don't know how to say it. Frivolous. Yeah, shouldn't be frivolous in the study of Torah, and he shouldn't treat even the books with contempt. That's why when a sefer falls on the floor, you pick it up and kiss it. You know what it's like? It's like you're standing with the world's greatest surgeon, and you are a surgeon in training, and they're doing surgery on Einstein's brain. And he has not yet completed general relativity, and he suffered a hemorrhage, and this could either save Einstein or not save Einstein. And your master surgeon has been chosen to be the one to operate, and you're there helping him, and you can do some subsidiary cutting and subsidiary patching and so forth and so on. How would you go about this? Would you, you know, when you're waiting for your turn, would you toss the knife up and down, you know, and catch it? I mean, how would you feel? You'd feel, on the one hand, awestruck that you, of all the surgeons of the world, were chosen to operate on Einstein's brain. And on the other hand, you would feel a sense of privilege and greatness that you are recognized to have that kind of ability. And you would be in the world in a serious, I'd say almost exalted state of feeling for the opportunity that you've been given what to do. Here, you're taking something infinitely more important than Einstein's brain. And you're given the opportunity to interact with it and use it to create perfection for yourself and bring perfection to the world. You're getting a piece of God's own existence, so to speak, made available to you. So if that doesn't strike you with awe, if that doesn't, now I think I'm going to try a little explanation here. If that doesn't strike you with awe, then you're not paying attention. You're not paying attention. You're not focused on what you're doing. And if you're not paying attention, you're not focused on what you're doing, then you don't belong doing it. You don't belong doing it. Okay, this is degrees and levels. But a person who's too far from it, that his spirituality is not invested in what he's doing, I want this point to get across vividly. I mentioned to you a psychopath. You know what a psychopath is? It's a person for whom other people's pain just doesn't register. It doesn't register. It doesn't mean anything. He doesn't cognize it. So the example of a psychopath is he has a knife and he wants to put it down. Where should I put it down? Well, I could put it down on the table, or I could put it down in his arm. Now, it's true, when I put it down in his arm, it leaks that red stuff, you know, and it gets messy. To take that into account. And he does yell. It's very noisy when he yells. So I have to take that into account, you know. The yelling is very noisy. But on the other hand, it ruins the table if I put it in the table. So maybe I'll put it in his arm. The pain of the person doesn't register. He just doesn't register. There's something missing in his brain and in his experience. This category is cut out. It's not that he wants to hurt people. It's not that he's a sadist. That he's hurting people just doesn't register with him. Now, you don't want such people let loose on the world, right? Because they can do all sorts of terrible, terrible things. You know, parking his car, the person's standing in the way. Well, you know, so he's standing in the way, so I'm parking my car. If he gets run over, so what? It's like, it doesn't bother him. This doesn't mean anything to him. Here, it's the same thing. It's the same kind of blindness. The person's interacting with the greatest divinity that's in the world, and he's just, you know, casual, calm, everything's fine, nothing exciting happening, nothing special happening. That person's spirituality is not online, as we would say. And if a person's spirituality is not online, then at a certain point, if it's too seriously offline, then he certainly won't interact with that influence. And that he will say it could be even dangerous for him to engage in the activity because he's doing it in a way that is degrading to the reality that he's interacting with. Yeah.
You mentioned about if you study Torah without awe of God and mitzvah remaining on awe on us, then it's like studying other subjects. So I mean, does he mention at all there, or like how practically you can get this all before or while you're studying it, and then your studying can be what you want it to be?
No, he doesn't say anything about the practicalities of developing awe of God. Maimonides talks about it in the Laws of the Fundamentals of the Torah, chapter 3 or 4. He has some suggestions. Maybe we'll talk about it, but I want to get the ideas about Talmud Torah out on the table. And now he goes on at the end of the paragraph and he says the person who studies it without awe, this is like he's reading some other material, so it will be regarded as a crime because he's taking something holy. And he's treating it as if it were not holy. And therefore, if he's really on too low a level of awe of God, then it becomes a negative. It becomes a negative activity. It's not positive at all. And the second requirement is that there be some appropriate level of observance of mitzvos. Because he's going to bring that influence into himself. And if he performs transgressions, then he pollutes himself. And by polluting himself, he doesn't create a home. He doesn't create a setting into which that influence will come and feel that it's coming to an appropriate place. And that's why the verse says, in Tehillim, God said to the wicked person, why are you reciting my laws? It says a person that Talmud says like a person who learns Torah with an inappropriate purpose, it's like he's worshiping an idol. And he certainly will not have any influence in contact with that influence whatsoever. Then he says a qualification. What we've talked about up until now is this highest influence, this highest divinity that God put into the world, and how it's externally connected with the Torah. Externally means you get it only if you fulfill the conditions that God laid down for it. There is, however, another thing called the light that is in it. That's internal. And a person who studies it like chemistry, light that is in it can have an effect on him, and may very well have a spiritual effect on him. Of course, he'll be totally unaware of it, but it could still have an effect on him. However, it is possible for a person to be so degraded that he can block even that. And that's a person who studies the Torah in order to degrade it, in order to misinterpret it, to misapply it, to make fun of it.
To justify his disbelief.
Correct. To justify his disbelief. I mentioned to you we had a girl who consulted with one of my colleagues here many years ago, studying at Hebrew Union College. And she was taking a Talmud course, which was optional, but she decided to take it. And the professor said in the first class, "I have chosen tractate Sukkah because that tractate illustrates well just how silly the Talmud is." Here's a guy. Here's a guy who even the internal light that is essential to the Torah is not going to be available to him, because he's blocked it out. He's blocked it out. Okay, those are the rules. Now, what's going on here? So I will try to give you a little peek behind the curtain as best I can. Not that I understand these things very well, but we spoke about this a couple of times in general terms. When we talk about God, what do we mean? What are we talking about? We can't talk about who He is or what He is, His essence, because that's beyond all description, beyond all understanding, beyond all language, beyond all concept. So instead of talking about what He is, we talk about what He does. What He does is action and will. We can talk about His will. We mentioned that an action is not just a body moving. It's a body moving with an intention, with a goal, with a conception of a purpose, and the conception of a world in which that purpose is going to take place. So this we can talk about. God's will. Now, how could we relate? How could we relate to God's will? How could we connect with God's will? How could we interact with God's will? So in general, there are two ways. One is to fulfill His will. To do it. God wants X done, and I do it. Then I'm connecting with His will that X be done. A deeper way to connect with His will is to identify with Him, to make His will my will. Now, the essential element in any rotzon, in any will, is the purpose. So, to identify with God's will would mean to take on for myself His purpose. If I know what His purpose is, and I make His purpose my purpose, then I'm internalizing His will. I'm also a creature that's capable of will. If God is will, that's all I have of Him. I mean, that's all He is to me. That's all I can think of or talk about or relate to or understand or conceptualize. So for me, God is will. And I take on God's will. That is to say, I pledge myself to do it, and I identify with its purpose, then God's will is in me. If God is God's will, and God's will is in me, then God is in me. And I am God-like. I'm taking on divinity. Of course, I'm only doing it the way a creature can do it, not the way God does it. So it's only by analogy, and it's only partial. But it's the same category, it's the same ballpark, it's the same dynamics. I'm taking on God's will. Now, the study of Torah, the Torah is the blueprint of God's will. There it is. All of the things that need to be done, which I can pledge myself to do, and all of His purposes, which I can identify with. So, if I study the Torah with this goal, it's not just understanding. It's not just an academic subject. No, it's using it as the vehicle of dvekus, of attaching myself to him. I attach myself to him, seeing that he's will, by taking the information of Torah and identifying with it. Identifying with it means on two levels. Understanding that the Torah is a description of what he wants done and why he wants it done. And that's all it is. For Ramchal, that's really all it is. It's what he wants done and why he wants it done. There's nothing else. And I pledge myself to do what he wants done. And I pledge myself to do it for the reason that he wants it done, because I identify with the reason as well. Then I have taken on to myself directly this elokus, this godliness that's in the world. This is now not a matter of perfecting the various parts of the world. It's not its extent. It's not its being a blueprint of everything else. It's a matter of absorbing into myself God's will. That is a way to explain why this will put me in the highest position, because this is the representative of what he is. That's why this vehicle was chosen. You know, it wasn't arbitrary. I have a gold brick. Now I need to carry around the gold brick. What shall I carry around? A pouch or a carriage or a tied around the neck of a carrier pigeon? You know, I mean, you can move gold bricks in lots of different ways. What difference does it make? You know, I'll put it in my knapsack. No. The vehicle was designed specifically for this highest influence. The highest influence, if God is will, has to be itself a kind of will. This vehicle enables the person who studies it to identify with that will, and in such a way he becomes connected to it, a representative of it, an expression of it, and in that way he takes on divinity in his person as much as such a thing is possible for a creature in the world. That could be some of an explanation of what he means when he says this influence is the highest possible influence and it is connected to this particular vehicle. I'll try to repeat that tomorrow so that the idea will be clear. I think this is a very important idea.